For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
To get by Benning. Darnell Nurse left it in the corner. Gets up center. Perry! Scores! Corey Perry!
Well, you're able to shake away from Solani. It's given away to Solani. Around the front. Score! Teemu Solani with the steal.
Three in the face. One. Score! Off the floor! On the board! Paul Kariya!
Paint lately, so that's just anyways, sorry,
that's something. I can see by your background.
Yeah,
it's great.
It's nothing matters, bro. It's all fine.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. Perfect timing to decide to do a show, push it back from the Sunday, and hey, it works out for once. We were supposed to go live yesterday, and we said, you know what, Ducks play the Islanders tonight. Something magical might happen, and that's exactly how it went. And we'll push it back to Monday night. And Pat Verbeek heard our prayers, and Josh Manson's now a member of the Colorado Avalanche, and we've got something to talk about today, other than the fact that the Ducks lost the last couple games. So I can see you're fully ready to talk about the loss of your prodigal son, Josh Manson. So.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is obviously a tough day for me personally. the best Duck in the history of the franchise has been traded away. You know, my large adult son, Joshua David Manson, now has to go play with hippies in Denver, which is very sad.
Doesn't even get to reunite with his dad in Winnipeg. He's got to go to Colorado, of all places. What a tough place.
Or even Edmonton. His pops is in Edmonton.
Oh, right. Edmonton. That's where his dad is, right? Was his dad in Winnipeg or somewhere? That's where he played, right? That's where he played.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, his dad played in Winnipeg. Right. His dad played for Winnipeg and Chicago. When he got traded, I went to see if he was ever on a team with Grant Fuhr. Dave Manson was ever on a team with Grant Fuhr, and he wasn't. So that was a bummer.
You're getting Batman references already. So I am Ben.
There's a lot going on. Some real dumbass. Anyways, but it's I couldn't find my Talia Shire, what do you call it, like black veil, so I had to improvise. Preferably, I would do like, you know, one of those classic, like, in mourning mother in all black kind of clothes, but I don't have any of that. But we all knew it was coming, right? And I tweeted it out from the FM account. I thought it's pretty remarkable that the first real trade that happens is the one that sends Josh Manson out the door. Like, I don't know that there is a more perfectly kind of tidy symbol or metaphor for the shift that we're seeing, you know, and then you go, do you take it down to the next level? and you look at what the trade package was in return, and again, it's the same kind of thing. Like, this is a very easy thing to extrapolate 1,000 different narratives from, and I think that's an interesting thing. But I guess, like, that's the first place to start, Eddie, and I want to ask you this, is...
I'm just watching you, like, fade in and out of existence with like, the Batman mask on. It's just
but for real, like, how do you feel about Josh Manson to Colorado?
Let's talk about the
immediate part of this trade.
I think if we're looking at it from a Colorado standpoint, I think it's a great ad for the team. Presumably, like, obviously, you know, everybody ranks their prospect pool differently, but for them, like, they hang on to kind of the top five prospects that they have left. I know there was a few people out there. Corey Pronman was, I think, the highest on Helison of everybody. He had him number four at the beginning of the year behind Makar, Newhook, and Byram. So that, I mean, he's probably the highest of anybody on him. Wheeler, in his most recent rankings, had Helison at number eight. So you're looking at kind of like a middle-of-the-pack prospect for a team that has a middle-of-the-pack prospect pool now that Byram and Makar and almost Newhook have graduated at this point. So I think for Colorado's standpoint, like, you get some depth on the right side. You kind of add maybe something you didn't have when you look at Byram, Girard, and Makar, the type of defenseman that they have. You've got now, like, another physical presence to go along with Eric Johnson there. They're adding him for just over $2 million because the Ducks retained 50%. And all it costs you is a guy who could potentially turn into what Josh Manson is now in a second-round pick. You keep a hold of that first-round pick to go out and still maybe go for Claude Giroux or JT Miller or something along those lines. So I think if you're Colorado and you're Joe Sakic, this is kind of the perfect move for you. But at the same point, like, the Ducks get what they should have wanted and what was probably the best offer they could have got for Josh Manson. So it's one of those rare trades where, you know, it's not a hockey trade necessarily. There's some picks involved, but it's one of those ones, like, it's not an A-plus for any team, but it's a solid B, I think, for both teams, which is, hey, like, if for Pat Verbeek's first big trade in Anaheim, it's not the worst outcome you could expect.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, look, I think as far as, like, Manson is concerned, I think this puts him in a really perfect place to kind of, you know, recoup some of that lost, I guess, like, hey, what are we doing?
Sorry. It's upset. Just as upset
as
you.
Off the fucking rails here. It's ridiculous. I know. But where are you going, dude? Jesus. Anyways, like, I think it's a great way for him to kind of recoup some of that lost value that he's kind of had publicly as far as, you know, how the Ducks have played and how, you know, he's been on the team and he has had a down couple of years. Again, I'm very vocal about that being a little overstated. But it's hard to argue that it isn't true to just from an objective standpoint, right? He has been a little bit worse than he has in the past. The team as a whole has struggled. So his value in the eyes around the league is a little lower than it is. I think the reason that we saw him get a solid return still like this is the same reason we've heard Ben Chiarot's name in a first round pick in the same sentence for, you know, 6 months now. It's just, he plays a type of game, and unlike Chiarot, he's a right-handed pick and like, or a right-handed shot. Like, he plays a type of game that, you know, if you want to be cynical, you can say that your standard 200 hockeymen believe has more value than skill. And if you want to be, you know, I don't know, I guess a realist, you could just say, or I guess like a romantic in a sense, it would be he's got a game that gets better in the playoffs and all that kind of stuff. I think the truth of it is that it's a little bit both true, right? Like, he has that off-ice value, that in-room value. He brings that kind of intangible toughness to the team, right? Like, he's one of those guys that I think everybody has a more traditional usage of the term grit for. But, like, he's not a bad hockey player. And I think grit has kind of become synonymous with plug in a way that I think is a little ridiculous. But he's a really good player, and he's going to do a really good job for them. He's going to give them a very specific element. He's going to probably end up in a role that I've always wanted for him, which is he's going to end up basically being the right-handed training wheels for a super skilled young left-handed defenseman. You're going to have Gerard or Byram or one of these guys play with him, and they're going to be able to excel in a role that is going to be very easy for them, because he's going to be back there. He's going to make sure that they have space. He's going to be able to go and do the things in front of the net that's maybe some of your smaller modern defensemen can't do. He's just, I just think he makes them a better team, all things considered. He's going to be able to eat up a bunch of penalty kill minutes for them that aren't going to now be going to like Curtis McDermott, right? I think was playing for them, or Zach McEwen, one of the two.
Yeah, they had their Gerard and Byram out. Their bottom pairing is Jack Johnson, Curtis McDermott, and Ryan Murray's playing with Eric Johnson right now. So obviously, yeah, like Devin Taves and Makar, they're going nowhere. But like, if you think when Manson joins up and Gerard comes back, like the best spot for him, like him playing alongside a Sam Gerard type player on a good team, like you would hope, and I guess Colorado expects, is he gets back to prime Manson with Lindholm when the Ducks were good, right? Like that's kind of what you're hoping for. Where on a team where like nobody's underlying numbers are bad for the blue line, you would expect him to get back to that point.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, right? Is they're basically just going to have a second pairing that's going to be the B level of the first pairing. Sam Gerard is a young, skilled, dynamic offensive defenseman, but he's not Cale Makar. Josh Manson is an older veteran, more of a two-way defensive-minded type player. But I think it's fair to say he's not Devin Taves. You know what I mean? So they're just going to have a perfect, you know, B plus level second pair of what their first pair is, which is already one of the best pairs in hockey. Like, it's just going to put them in an incredible space as far as the kind of depth that they're going to be able to exert now. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I just wanted to make the point about the pairs are almost matching, because you're right. His perfect partner is with Sam Gerard.
No, yeah. And even like, I mean, it gets a lot worse if he doesn't go with Sam Gerard. And it will be interesting to see what Colorado does when Gerard and Byram come back. I know Byram is kind of up in the air because of the concussion problems on whether he's going to come back at all. But even if, like, let's say Byram's out, you've got Taves, Makar, Ryan Murray, Eric Johnson, Jack Johnson, Curtis McDermott, Josh Manson, and Sam Gerard. You've got eight guys. You know, you could argue Curtis McDermott's an easy seventh man, but you've still got some wiggle room there. Then Jack Johnson, somebody get dealt here at some point, I would imagine, if the Flyers, or sorry, not the Flyers, if the Avs go out and get a guy like Giroux or JT Miller, I would have to probably imagine the defenseman goes out the door and that evens out a bit. But even if he plays with Ryan Murray on a bottom pairing, like that's not a bad spot for him to be in either. I think obviously the ideal spot for him would always be to play with Sam Gerard, but you know, now if you're Colorado and you can roll into the playoffs with Taves, Makar, Gerard, Manson, Murray, Johnson, like that is one of the deepest six defense core, I think, in the entire league. And the top half is just elite when you have Makar and Devin Taves playing together. So from the Avs' point of things, it's amazing. I think they'll still go and look to add another forward now with Landeskog out until the playoffs. But, the rich keep getting richer, and that's usually how it works.
Yeah, man, I just think if nothing else, I'm so happy for Manson to be able to go into that kind of situation and be able to just step into a situation where, by and large, the culture seems to be really positive, other than the fact that Nathan MacKinnon is, a fitness Nazi. Other than that. But, I'm just really happy for Josh Manson, man. I think that's the thing that I've been trying to kind of focus on today is, like, I'm super bummed that he's not going to be on this team. I knew it was coming. I have said multiple times that it should happen. But this is one of those things where when the rubber meets the road, it sucks. And it's the best thing for all players involved. And I think you look at the return and they're going to get a second round pick in next year's draft, which is good because that helps them defer assets, right? It actually gives them an additional asset moving forward, right? Where, you know, to the extent that they get another pick in this year's draft, that the timeline on that is much shorter, obviously, because the draft is coming up. So you basically have between now and the trade deadline and then the 2 days you know, leading into the draft or whatever, where you can make trades and stuff like that to have the full value of that pick. Whereas because it's in the 2023 draft, that gives him a full draft, a full off season, and a full other trade deadline to have that pick have value for him. And he can, you know, if Anaheim is in a different position next year where they're looking to be buyers, right, in some crazy extent, it gives him something else. So I just think that's a great thing. And then you look at the kid that they got, and he's, you know, 20 years old. He's 6'3". He seems to be a little bit more of a two-way defender. Like, I saw the clip on Twitter today of him, and, like, I joked at Snail McCarr. Like, you know, he just moves so simple and so straightforward, and it's just, like, a nice little bit of play. But I just think it shows, you know, a level of poise and, you know, I guess sophistication in his skating that is a modern version, right, of what Josh Manson kind of was. I don't think anybody is going to be expecting Ellison to be as physical or, you know, violent, if you want, regarding, you know, some of the after whistle scrums and Josh's ability to just step into the fray and just destroy people. But he's going to give them now a very good, what would look to be, second pair right-handed defenseman behind Jamie Dreisdale. Like,
so you think of, like, with old Zellweger, the perfect complement for something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so I think from that point of view, like, yeah, the return makes a lot of sense. I think it's one of those trades, like you said, everybody comes out of it well, right? Like, we've seen some people, like, I think Dom LeCisson, you know, said in his reaction that he thinks Anaheim deserves to take a hit for not moving Manson earlier when his value is high. And I it's one of those things that, like, I get in a vacuum, but
it's all speculation. Like, what could they have gotten for him at that point, right?
Right. And it's a fair criticism, though, right? Because we have heard, you know, I mean, going into today, I mean, on the last, like, two or three episodes of 32 Thoughts, we've heard multiple times, everybody has been into Josh Manson for a couple years now. So, like, I think it's a fair criticism, given that some people may think that trading him on the expiring year was an inevitability. But I just think some of the non-asset management parts of it have a lot of value. I think having him play with Drysdale last year, I think having him play on this team this year, I think having him be a presence in this team for the last 2.5 years, like, it has real value for some of these younger players and some of the older players too. Like, that stuff matters. So, you know, again, like, in a vacuum, I understand the criticism, but I do think, you know, from a much more, you know, myopic or narrow-minded point of view, I guess, you know, narrow focus point of view than Dom has, like, I do think Anaheim was certainly justified in keeping him around with the hope that they would be adding him, you know, they would be signing him to an extension that was going to be them competing for another 4 years. It didn't play that way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, none of us have to sit and lie about what it is, but, you know, again, like, I think moving him now made a ton of sense. I think it was an inevitability given his next contract is just probably not going to be something that Anaheim was going to want from a bunch of different facets, as unfortunate as that is. And, you know, you have the no trade thing, you have the salary retention thing, like, all that. They got, you know, a fringe top five prospect, right? Because the two big numbers that I've seen so far have been 4 and 8. So, like, you're saying he's a top 10 prospect, second half of the top 10 prospect, you know, and, like, that's good, man. And, you know, I think you kind of alluded to this today in the group chat as far as, like, it's, I'd rather have a player who is as close to stepping into the league as Ellison is versus a first round pick, just because of where this team is, right? Like, we want to start seeing these guys get into the lineup sooner than later, as opposed to taking a kid who's going to be 4 years away. And there's still value in that, which is why they keep this year's pick, even if it is, you know, in the 13, 14, 15 range. But if you can go out and get a player who can hopefully be a roster player in a year and a half and a difference maker in 3, you're in a really good spot. So I think, you know, again, like, as far as grades for everybody, I think everybody did a really good job, and I'm a Colorado Avalanche fan now. So
Like, I agree with that in the sense that, you know, couple years ago when some teams were very hot for Josh Manson, you probably could have gotten more. You still would have ran into the issue of him not wanting to go to anywhere near the country of Canada and putting all the top teams on his list. So, you know, ultimately, I don't believe they would have gotten significantly more than what they got. And at the end of the day, for me, is you know, all what they could have, should have got at that point becomes a moot point, and it is, did they get enough for him now where they are? And I think they did. Like, I think, you know, again, the point you mentioned that I said in the group chat is, yeah, I would always rather a better prospect than a higher pick, especially when you think, in this case with Colorado, this pick is going to be 31 or 32, right, is what we kind of all expect with the Avalanche. For me, the difference between that and, you know, 50, 60, you know, a 2023 second round pick, even if it was a this year second round pick, like, there's really no difference in terms of the type of player you can get. It all depends on your scouting staff there. I would give the Ducks the same, you know, ability of drafting a good player at 50 or 60 than at 30, right? Like, I think it's relatively similar. So the fact that you can get a better player at that point, and you're not picking maybe the 12th or 13th best prospect in their system and getting a first round pick, you're getting a guy like this who, all things considered, it looks like he could play games for the Ducks this year, right? Like, that's pretty good. I mean, you could get a guy who could step in and meet him. Yeah, yeah. He's done his season with Boston College. He's in third year of college. Doesn't really need to go back for his senior year. And it seems like the perfect situation for him, because if he's in Colorado, why not go back for his senior year, right? I'm sure that was probably the plan. There's no way of really making it into the roster. You've got a bunch of guys in front of you. You've got, like, two defensemen in their system that are higher up than you. And, you know, that right side with Johnson and McCarr for the next couple of years, you're really not finding a way to break in there. You got Justin Barron, who's in the AHL, who's, like, their top prospect, who's right in front of you. So for him now, all of a sudden he comes into this system as what outside of Drysdale, and Drysdale's not really a prospect anymore. He's the top right-handed prospect they have. It's like him and Axel Anderson. And maybe you tip, you know, in Axel Anderson's favor just because he's played pro hockey this year. But he's obviously got a huge, you know, a huge boost to his path to the NHL. It's a lot sooner for him than it was before. So I would imagine, and I've seen a lot of people put this out there, that he probably gets signed in the next couple of days here, and then plays with San Diego for a bit. But I could see him getting a handful of games for the Ducks just to get a test. And it's awesome for that kid. It's awesome for the Ducks to be able to bring a guy like that into the organization and fast-track him and give him a chance. He's, you know, been one of the best two-way defensemen in college for the last couple of years. And like you said, like, for a guy who is 6'3", 204, he skates pretty well, right? He's just that modern defensive defenseman, the modern shutdown guy. He's not in the mold of Josh Manson in the sense that he's going to go out there and punish you physically. You know, the old school kind of shutdown defenseman who you can blow by them if you have enough speed, and they're likely going to be caught out of position every now and then. But if they catch you with your head down, you get knocked out, right? In this case, he's just exceptional at kind of timing and spacing. You know, his gap control is excellent. You're not really going to get past him. Yeah, he's got an active stick, and he's just kind of this smooth, effortless skating. He's not slow, but he just, you know, he doesn't use the speed when he doesn't have to. So it's and you saw that play, the play that you were talking about earlier, where he went coast to coast and dangled through a couple guys. So he's got that in his locker too. So, you know, if you want to just simplify it and say,
I'm still not sure we can call that, like, dangling. Like,
okay, so he attacked the triangles and put it under somebody's skate.
He oozed past them.
Yeah.
He just, it was hard for a guy that big. And it was super smooth.
Yeah.
No, that's the thing. Like, it's so funny, right? Because I'm not trying to shit on him. Like, it's a genuinely impressive play. And the fact that he actually made it at slow speed is almost more impressive than some of the similar plays people make at high speed. Mm-hmm. I just think it's just so funny to just see someone really just be like, I'm bigger and better than you, and I can do this at my own pace. Like, it felt very like peak, you know, peak 80s center in basketball kind of thing. It's just like, no, I'm just better than you, and I'm bigger than you, and it doesn't matter. You know, but yeah, it's a great thing. You know, I mean, look, it's him, it's Axel Anderson, it's Hunter Drew and
Ian Moore.
You know, and those are kind of the top.
Pretty much it, right? And all of a sudden he's fast-tracked in front of pretty much all those guys, and you know, other than Alex Anderson
playing. Oh, dude, here's the other thing. Right? So. He's a, yeah, he's he. Plus, he's a Verbeek. Like, I don't. Verbeek, he's the first guy Verbeek brought in.
Yeah.
I think that pushes him even closer to the front of the line, right?
Yeah.
Because this is a guy that doesn't seem that far away and is going to give Verbeek an opportunity to kind of show something to prove the fans himself. As far as what he's looking for.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Prove that he won the trade, because this is a tough one. It's a tough first move in moving out a fan favorite like Josh Manson. For a guy that a lot of people...
Is he still a fan favorite?
I would say the majority of people still like Josh Manson.
I'm being petulant. Don't ignore me.
But yeah, you're exactly right in the sense that there's going to be a lot of people upset that they moved him. And for most people, for a guy that they don't really know and have not either heard about before or probably won't look into, and that's... I'm not, you know, trying to target anybody here, but the truth
is... So many hours in a day.
Yeah, Drew Helison just is not a guy that jumps off the page. You probably haven't heard of him before. I've heard of him a handful of times before this, and I looked this shit up religiously, and I still like have only kind of roughly heard his name every now and then. So it's going to be one that, yeah, you want to prove yourself. Get this kid in the lineup. You know, obviously don't rush him to a point where he's not ready, but he's close enough that you can get him in this year and get him familiar with the fans. And for Verbeek, you know, try and get an early win, because it's going to be a tough offseason to endear yourselves to a lot of the fans when the first thing you're doing is moving out fan favorites like Manson and Raquel and Lindholm. But it's, you know, it's something you got to do. And it's funny, he's sticking to his word pretty quickly, because somebody had mentioned, I think it was Felix had mentioned that, you know, every broadcast now they're releasing tidbits of this interview between Verbeek and Hayward. And a couple games ago, he was prioritizing size on the blue line. As he was saying, the rules have made it difficult for smaller D-men to defend. And, you know, the Ducks' two top defensemen in their prospects pool right now are Drysdale and Zellweger, under 5'11", right? So you look at some of the other guys like Thrun 6'3", and Lacombe 6'2", so they got some bigger guys there. But the first move he does to bring in a younger player is he goes out and gets a 6'3", mobile shutdown defenseman to kind of go along with what he was saying there. So if that's to kind of foreshadow future moves, on the last broadcast he said he was looking to add speed to the lineup, so we'll see an acquisition of a young quick forward maybe at some point here to add to the roster. But yeah, I think all things considered, like I really do like this deal. I think you bring in a modern younger version of Josh Manson that, you know, this guy is likely going to be a 5 or 6 just already at the NHL level. And the difference between him getting to, you know, a number 4 is how well is his offensive game going to translate to the NHL level. You know, can he put up 20 to 30 points while also, you know, being this physical shutdown dominant defender? If he can, he's a top 4 guy. If not, he's a 5-6, and he's a specialist guy. You throw him out in the PK, still plays 19-20 minutes a night. There's nothing wrong with that, right? At all. That's...
So this is kind of a different but similar conversation. I don't think he has to put up points to be a top 4 defenseman. I was literally just talking about this with my uncle, like, driving home from work today, because we were just like talking about Manson and the trade and all that kind of stuff, and it's his fault I root for this stupid team. But you know, one of the things that I had mentioned to him is, like, I don't think it's fair or realistic to expect all of your top 4 defensemen to have to be able to put up points. Like, there is still something to being said for denying other teams from being able to score goals. Like, you know, you could say it's cliche or pedantic or childish or whatever, but it's like, dude, defender is in the position. They are defensemen. Like, they play defense. Like, it is okay that these guys just be really, really good at not letting other people score. That's why there's 4 other guys on the ice, is to help accentuate that. And given what we've seen of his, you know, his handles and the fact that he's putting up 25 and 32 at BC, like, there's reason to be optimistic about what his offensive upside could be. But even if he just does develop into a better skating Manson, as far as putting up, whatever amount of points, but just being a guy that can reliably shut down other players, like, I don't think that that's a bad thing. And I don't think it's unfair to ask for that to be a third defenseman on a good team.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's well, about Lindholm the situation forever, right? You put these guys in. It's about implementation. Yeah, but that's exactly what I'm saying, right?
Yeah, Lindholm, you know, classified as a number
was
so good one.
At defense, it was, well, he's not a one.
Yeah. Yeah, it was always you know, the offense wasn't there, so people were like, yeah, he's not a one because he's not McCarr or, you know, Erik Karlsson at the time, right? So that was always the debate in Lindholm's case, is he was so good at everything else, but you know, he wasn't.
Well, he wasn't 40, even a Doughty, right?
Yeah, yeah. So that and listen, I completely agree with you. I think you can be a number four, and you don't have to be a point producer. It just depends on what team you're on. And I think when you look at the way the Ducks are building this team, where hopefully Drysdale and Zellweger are carrying the offense, Fowler's still sticking around doing his thing, you can be a four on this team,
whatever that is.
Yeah, and whenever it is at whatever point, and be a, you know, just a dominant shutdown guy, and that's your get on this team. Like, you're that guy and you're so valuable, yeah, in that way.
Absolutely.
That, yeah, you can be a four. And I think, you know, the modern interpretation of being a top four defenseman at this point is that you kind of have to do everything well. And that just seems, just because of the way defensemen have kind of trended at this point, is you got to be a great skater. You got to put up points. You got to defend well. And you kind of get looped into this, like, all around, you got to do everything well. And you can't just, you know, you can't just do one thing exceptional and one thing not so great. But I do agree. I think he can be a four on this team, but in the, like, what the term top four defenseman is almost morphed into. It's like you gotta put up points. It feels like, which is unfair because you can still be an effective top four defenseman without putting up points.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I just think it is unfair to hold guys to these expectations that they have to be point producers to be considered a top four defenseman. I just don't think that's fair, and I also think that's unrealistic. I think you're needlessly getting rid of players that can be helpful members of teams, like really impactful players. Again, when played with the appropriate players and played well, you know, played in the appropriate situations, like, again, like, that's the job of your coaching staff, is to get these guys in the best positions possible to succeed. If one of the things that he doesn't do, like, if one of the things that I'm not asking of him for as a term of success is to put up 40 points, then it's on you to make sure that you're not putting him in a position where he has to produce or it's a negative, right? Like, don't put him on the power play. That's fine. Just let him play all the power penalty kills. Let him play a 5-on-5. Let him be a defensive guy. Pair him with a guy like Olin Zellweger, who is just so dynamic and so skilled and smaller and faster. And it is a match made in heaven as far as being able to put a pair on the ice and be able to do both things. So I don't know. It's a little bit of hobby horse. I'm on a soapbox or whatever you want. Like, it's a little ridiculous, but I just think it's a really good player, and mm-hmm. skating is important in the modern game. And I think more than anything, that's what needs to be focused on here, I guess, is that he is a good skater, right? That is the thing that will allow him to be, because if he was a mediocre skater, then yes, he's a 5-6 guy, right? He's your Corbinian Holzers. He's good in his own end. He's good when he doesn't have to move his feet too much, but once you start getting him moving north and south, it's a little bit of a problem. You know, so I think his skating is a huge plus as far as his ability to be impactful and to be a more successful player higher in a lineup.
And I think he's, you know, he's not a good skater in the same sense as Jamie Drysdale's a good skater, where, like, he'll blow by you.
Jamie Drysdale's not a good skater. He's a great skater.
Exactly.
He's an exceptional skater.
But it's just like it's a different utilization of his skating. Like, his north-south speed, he's not going to blow by you at any point. Drew Ellison's just not that guy. But he's so good defensively with his, you know, his spacing and his gap control, that he's got some quickness to him, that he's already in such a good position that he doesn't need to make up that ground to really, you know, catch up to you. And he's got the size to kind of block you off already. So his skating is just, like, the best way I can kind of say it is it's just smooth for a bigger guy, right? Like, it's effortless. Right. There's not...
He's got good feet.
Yeah, it's not ugly.
Like, if it was basketball or football, he's got good feet.
Yeah, yeah. It's not speed, but it's just his skating ability, his all-around skating ability is great for a guy his size. And to be an effective now shutdown defenseman in the NHL, where the guys coming against you, like the McDavids, the McKinnons of this league, where they're just lightning quick, you've got to be able to have that ability, which, for me, the big get for this is maybe not how he profiles himself and where he's going to land, but for the Ducks prospect pool in general, there is no, they don't have anybody like this right now, which I think is huge to bring in. We talked about this in the past couple shows where we're looking at potential guys to go out and get. And I think a few times we looked at guys like Braden Schneider and Scott Morrow in Carolina and just big, rangy, mobile, right-handed defensemen, because there isn't anybody on the right side if Josh Manson goes out. And it's a great get to, you know, Josh Manson goes, and in that deal, you bring back that guy who can fill that hole on the right side of defense in your prospect pool, or at least add to it, which is right now, if you're adding to the Ducks prospect pool in general, that's probably the weakest point and the best spot you can add to. So I love it just in that sense. I love it when you look at the player and see where he projects. I always like to see, you know, year-on-year production increases no matter what year, league he's playing in, and every year he's played in the NCAA for the last 3 years, he's gotten better. And then there's something to be said about the fact that he played in the same program at the same time as Trevor Zegras and Henry Threat, right? Like, there's some familiarity with these guys there at some point, and you can call it intangible and meaningless or whatever at some point, but these guys know each other, and I think that does go a long way eventually when you're putting these guys together on a team. They've done it before. And when it's a big piece like Trevor Zegras, who's going to be here for a while and potentially a guy you could play with in Henry Thrun, I think that's important.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think, I mean, you know this because I, you know, pester you with this shit in like soccer, but it's like, I love that national team shit, man. I eat that stuff up. Like, yeah. I love the idea of having multiple guys who play their international soccer, or in this case hockey, together, because I just think it gives them time together to do all of the things that you want them to do for you outside of you. And I think that's the part of it that's super beneficial, is, you know, they're getting other people, getting their hands on them as far as getting these exposure to different ideas or different expectations or different style or whatever it is. I just think there's a lot of value to that, going through that process together. But the other thing is, like you said, like it's crazy. Like, when you think about it, like, I think you could pretty reasonably say they've got three good goalie prospects in Dostal, Eriksson-Ek, and Alexander. They've got two legitimate top six centers in the pipeline in McTavish and Zegras. They've got plenty of top six wingers. They've got Tracy and Perreault and potentially Colangelo and
Pastyov,
thank you. You know, then they've got your lower guys down the lineup, your Perbix and Shigurl and, you know, Galimov and some of these guys. And then, you know, you've got a good set of left-handed depth. You've, like you said, Thrun and Moore and Lakem and some of these other guys. And then the right side, like, it almost feels like we're a real hockey club again, because the thing that we don't have is right-handed defensive depth.
Right.
And it's crazy. It's like,
had it,
know,
for
like
so long.
For a one point. Yeah, that was the one thing Anaheim did have in spades. But two, I think it also says a lot about how successful this scouting staff has been in finding these players and bringing them in, that, like, you can look to, you know, and again, the top six center thing is a little hard. There's only those two guys, but, like, two guys is better than no guys. But, like, with every other position, you can find two, three guys easy who you're, like, they're in contention for this spot. And that, I think, is very valuable and very important. And this, like you said, is something that begins to address the deficiency on the right-hand side and with our right-hand shooting depth, and especially with, you know, Drew seemingly moving to forward full-time, you know, and we've seen it with Brent Burns and Brendan Smith and Dustin Byfuglien. Like, you know, different guys play back and forth for different teams depending on what is being asked of them, you know, by the coaching staff. Like, we've seen Corbinian Holzer play at forward in the NHL, for God's sakes. You know, so there's something to that versatility. But it does seem that he is going to be expected to be, like, a checking winger now. And So to, again, bring in somebody who, you know, again, one of the big issues with Drew is his skating. That's not the issue here. He's still going to have, you know, that size and that reach. And like you said, his ability to leverage his skating alongside with his size and his frame gives him an ability to be very impactful in his own end. You know, hopefully he develops some of that snarl or bite or whatever you want to call it. But if nothing else, he, like you said, he very clearly addresses a point of need in this prospect pool. And you never want to pin your hopes on one prospect. That's always how you get into trouble, but it's a good start, and it's the first one that we've seen from Verbeek, and it's a very encouraging start.
Yeah, the one thing I've really liked about the Ducks draft in the last few years, and listen, it has to be intentional, but I you know, I always go and advocate for drafting the best player available, but you can see like where some of these guys fit in an eventual lineup if they hit, where you have kind of all the pieces you would want for a championship team. You've got your scoring winger, so you've got your your Perreaux, your Pastuovs, your Tracys. You know, you've got then your kind of two-way guys in Shigurl, and you've got your physical guys in Jones and Colangelo that can kind of sprinkle in the bottom of the lineup. And, you know, you've obviously got your two, you know, A-plus pieces in Zegras and McTavish down the middle. You filled it out with some acquisitions like Milano. And then on defense, you know, you've got your, hopefully, your McCarr-type player in Jamie Drysdale in the sense of, you know, puck-moving, mobile offensive defenseman who can run the power play. You've got Zellweger, who comes in to kind of be a secondary guy like that, like almost a Girard, who he's been compared with in Colorado. And now you've got Hellison to be that kind of right-handed shutdown guy. And you've got a lot of depth guys coming up that kind of fill both sides of the game. Physical shutdown guys like Thrun and some bigger, rangier offensive mobile guys like Jackson Lacombe. And, you know, you've kind of built all these pieces together with a prospect pool, just really complements itself. And they had that one weakness on the right side, and they said, listen, that's what we got to go out and get. And in your first move, you go out and get that. And, you know, maybe that gives you some freedom now in some of the bigger deals, which we should probably get to at some point here. And, you know, if Lindholm gets moved, and all signs point that he probably will, and same with Rickard Rakell, that the secondary needs now, and maybe going out and, you know, get another right-handed defenseman, some more scoring winger help, but you can kind of be a little bit more flexible with that you don't have this glaring hole now. You've filled it in some sense. And obviously one guy doesn't really change too much, where the Ducks still have some holes on the right side of defense in their prospect pool. But it does give you a little bit of freedom, I think, to look at some other options, and maybe you fill that right side hole in the draft now that you've got another body in there. So I love it. I'm still excited for the deadline. I'm hoping that Verbeek can hold off a little bit for our live show on Monday, that we have a little bit to talk about at that point. But man, like it sucks because it's bittersweet, right? Like, it sucks to see these guys go. They've been a big part of, you know, us watching Ducks hockey over the last decade. But it is exciting to see some new blood come in and see, you know, there's a commitment to the rebuild, right? And doing things the way we kind of hoped that Bob Murray would have done over the last couple of years, that, you know, if you can't re-sign these guys, then they're out the door. And if they don't re-sign for your terms, you're not going to be raked across the coals, right? Like the latest news I've seen from Hampus Lindholm is that the Ducks want him around 5 years and he wants more. And if that's the non-starter, like he's not going to do five and you're not going to do more, then we're going to trade him. And I like that approach. You know, you stick to your guns, and you have something you're comfortable with, and you know, if it's out of your range, then you're going to get something for him. And I ultimately think that's where it's going to go. But it's an exciting week coming up, man. It's already kicked off. The dominoes are starting to fall.
There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy, because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post, so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's never often that the Ducks are the ones to kick things off, right? Like, usually we're waiting until other guys have gotten traded, so.
Well, that's, you know, that's what, like, second, I guess, athletic pimp today, like, Gentile made that point as far as, like, this feels like the start of trade season now. Like, you know, all due respect to Tyler Toffoli, he got traded in February. And now we're in the, you know, the week heading into the trade deadline, the middle of March, all that kind of stuff. So it just does feel different. It's fascinating that the Ducks were such a central figure in the way that this deadline was going to play out just to begin with. And then now to see them really step up and make this kind of big trade, again, as inevitable as it may have felt, unexciting as the name Drew Helison is, like you said, you know, a lot of people don't know him. Like, I hadn't really heard his name before. Like, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, is that thing? But like, if you told me I just was thinking of Hellman's mayonnaise, like, I'd believe you. So, you know, I think it's going to be an interesting thing. I wanted to say one thing real quick, as you mentioned about, the speed that Verbeek has been talking about. I have a buddy named George Fitzgerald who writes, he's a Tampa Bay fan. He writes for Raw Charge. I think it's called Raw Charge. It's the SB Nation, yep. Tampa Bay site. It's great. I know a bunch of the writers there. They're really, really wonderful. But he made a really interesting point to me a little while ago that the thing to watch with Verbeek, that he, you know, because Verbeek was kind of the head of scouting for under Iserman. And obviously that was a thing that was in Tampa Bay and then in Detroit as well. And now he's coming in with, you know, again, a scouting experience, which he earned, is his post-career from playing. Is he said, you're going to see your forwards get smaller and faster, and you're going to see your defensemen get bigger. And so far, the two things that we've seen him do is add Schuster off Oysters. add Schuster off of waivers. And now trade Josh Manson for Drew Helison, who is, again, a bigger, more physical defenseman.
Yep.
Even the modern version of that. Again, like, I almost kind of feel weird.
It's not the traditional
big
defenseman, right? Like, it was the walls at that point. Now you're getting this kind of modern version of it, which it works better that way. I feel more comfortable with him going after the 6'4", 6'5", defensemen as long as they've got some skill to them. So,
right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? We're not going to see a lot of Hunter Drews. It's going to be a lot more of these type of guys, where that physicality is an accent as opposed to a feature. You know, but I just want to say that really smart guy, he made that point, and so far it's been true. So to your point about what we're going to see with the kind of the returns that or other just trades in general that he's going to be making over the next week, because I do think there's going to be plenty of more moves. I think people are going to get moved that we're not expecting. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if that's going to be as impactful as a Henrik or a Silverberg, or if it's going to be a smaller thing like a Grant or a Steele even. You know, but I do think we're going to see somebody that we're not really prepared kind of to leave is going to get traded. But is to see if he really does start to go for those more faster skilled type forwards, because I don't know that that's something Anaheim has a ton of. I think they have good skill and good speed. But I don't know that we really have any like burners in the minors right now or in the prospect pool. You know, I mean, hell, Pastyov specifically isn't that.
Yeah.
You know, so it's going to be interesting to see if that's something he tries to address with the Raquel and Lindholm trades.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just a notice from him that he just thinks this team isn't quick enough. He wants to add some speed, and whether that's, you know, bringing in prospects who fit that mold or not, you know, we'll have to see. But there's, you know, even with his time in the Red Wings, you can look at the Red Wings, they're drafting for defensemen, Edvinson and Sider coming in. I think Edvinson's 6'5", and Sider's like, what, 6'2", 6'3"? Like, they're big kids. And obviously
6'4".
There's a lot of skill there, right? But that there's some identity that they're building on the blue line. Now, that doesn't mean that, I know Verbeek wasn't a part of this, but it doesn't mean he doesn't like players like Drysdale and Zellweger. There's an exceptional amount of skill to those players that you can overlook that. But the rest of the players, it seems like he wants to complement that, which, again, makes sense. are big, you know, mobile, rangy defensemen that that have some size and skill on the back end, and that's what we're starting to see here. So yeah, again, there's a lot of interesting pieces for the Ducks to move. There's some prospects out there that you could target, but it makes me wonder, like, you know, Toronto's case, a guy like Topi Niemelä, who is a right-handed defenseman that Toronto is willing to move, only 5'11". Does that maybe, you know, could be thinking into this too much, but does that maybe take him off the table? And whereas you've got a guy in Carolina like Scott Morrow, who's 6'2" and kind of can do the same thing. He's a little bit bigger, and does that appeal to you more when you're trying to build a team a certain way? And same thing goes for forward prospects, is maybe do you take the skilled, quicker winger over, you know, a bit more of a power forward approach, and you go with that team's offer.
Oh, you mean like maybe Fabian Lysell, who's a young, quick forward?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah. Heard it here first, folks. Eddie says Fabian Lysell is a future Duck, and he thinks anybody who says the opposite of that is silly and foolish.
No, my
huge
ideal
Fabian Lysell fan. Eddie,
ideal moves are still Lindholm going to Carolina and Scott Morrow, a first or some picks coming back for that, and Mikkel going to the Rangers and Brennan Othman coming back the other way. I think you get both there.
Okay, so here's the question. I'm just real quick, we're going to entertain your nonsense since you entertained mine this entire time. What else is in that deal, or who is Anaheim taking back to get the Rangers' best forward prospect that isn't currently underwhelming in their middle six?
That one is a bigger stretch than the Scott Morrow Lindholm to Carolina deal, because Lindholm holds a lot more value.
Like, do you have to send like Lundestrom the other direction?
I think you're bringing back some salary for some way for them to dump player. Well, like, you know, Gorgiev, I think we talked this before, and Stolarz maybe goes back the other way, and you help them eat some salary a bit there and make some additional moves.
I like that trade.
And it gives them, in a sense, I mean, listen, they're getting probably their top prospect who's not playing with them right now. But it gives you the ability to hold on to your first round pick and use it in a different way, right? And go out and add another player, which is what Colorado gets in the sense with this deal, right? Is they give up a better prospect than maybe they would have liked to, but they give up a second round pick that's not even this year. So they've got their first round pick for this year that they can still move and go out and get a top forward for them to be able to go do that, right? So that one's a stretch. It's just a player I really like and I think fits the fold there. But if you can go out and get somebody similar to that for Ricard Raquel, I think that's a win, right? If you can come out of this with another good defensive prospect and another forward prospect from those two guys and some picks, then it's a win in the deadline no matter what else you do if you're the Ducks, whether, you know, Henrique or Steele or Comtois get moved. I think you definitely 100% have to nail the three UFAs you have going out. You have to get something good, and you have to get a good return for those guys. And right now, I would say Verbeek is one for one, and he's got two other swings at the fence here to try and get some good offers in. And the good thing about
we're gonna
about
miss
it,
you, Delorier. We love you.
Yeah, if you get bringing a first for Delorier, you've won the deadline at all. But the good thing for Verbeek is that it gets easier in a sense with Lindholm and Raquel, because there isn't the no trade clause situation where, you know, Manson could have, I think it was a 12-team no trade list he could submit. You've got a little bit more flexibility here. And Lindholm is, from what all accounts you've heard, is the number one defensive prospect available. And Ricard Raquel is probably the best value forward available with the production versus the cap hit that he has. So, and the Ducks have the flexibility to eat 50% of Lindholm's contract still, even, you know, with them retaining 50% of Manson, it seems like they're willing to do so. And you eat 50% of Lindholm, and that all of a sudden bumps the value up and you can get a little bit more there. So I'm intrigued. I'm excited. I like this move by Verbeek. I think it shows some good signs for the next week here. And, man, I'm ready. I'm ready to fully commit to the rebuild finally. We got a guy heading in that direction instead of bouncing between two different philosophies. So it's good times. I know it's not good times for you, but it's good times.
What would give you the impression that I'm upset? The one thing I was going to say that you said that now is I actually thinking about it, like, who is the the best prospect left in Pittsburgh, because honestly, when you say it that way, it feels like Rakell to Pittsburgh for Kapanen and a picker prospect is kind of an inevitability.
I don't know why, I just don't think they don't have much left. Well, there is one guy.
Didn't just trade Pulley? Didn't they just trade him for?
No, I think they still have him. I don't think he was moved.
He's still there?
I believe they have the worst ranked prospect pool in the league, though, still. That's something that hasn't changed over the last couple of years.
Well, yeah, when you trade them all, then you don't have anybody, which, again,
Scott Wheeler has them at 29. Samuel Poulin is the number one ranked prospect. Number two is the guy who has been rumored to be traded out of there, Pierre-Olivier Joseph, left-handed defenseman. I could see it potentially.
Bring him in. Let's go.
You know, Kapanen is a want away from there. They want to get rid of him. If it's Kapanen and Joseph and small pick, maybe, or even if you have to do that at that point, like, again, you're getting a player you can inject in your lineup and replace Rakell right away in Kapanen. You've got a young left-handed defenseman who's playing in the AHL and is 22, so you could realistically, if Lindholm goes out the door, play him in the NHL right now and give him some decent minutes, potentially top 4 minutes, right behind Fowler for a second left-handed defenseman spot. There's some intrigue there if you want to maybe avoid the prospect side of things and get some, you know, players who are 20, 21, 22, 23 and see what they can do. And he's had a pretty good run at it so far. It's just a tough roster to break into as a prospect in Pittsburgh, right? Especially on that blue line that's had kind of the same guys there for a long time. So yeah, we could see something like that. And I think that's the exciting part about this is we know these guys are going to get moved, and there's a lot of different ways you can approach it and different types of players you could bring in. And we still, you know, we got the tidbits, like we said, he wants to add some faster forwards and some bigger guys on the blue line, but the way he could approach it, there's so many different avenues he could take, so it makes it a little bit interesting.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'll say it. You've talked me into it. Lundestrom for Malkin, one for one, fine, we'll make the trade. Look, we talked about this, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, I think, as far as, like, it was kind of scary and really exciting at the same time, because we know things need to happen. We know that things are going to happen in one sense or the other, right? There are things that have an obvious need for a legitimate conclusion before Monday, right? It's either these guys are getting extended or they're getting moved. We're not letting them walk out the door for nothing. So we know what it is that has to happen. Now we get to enjoy the part where we don't know anything about the people who are making the trade. Right? Like, we don't know what Verbeek is really like what he's trying to do, what he wants to accomplish. And, like, again, we can piece it together from certain things of him being a part of the last two teams, a major part of the front offices for Tampa Bay and Detroit. We know the things that he has said, but there is still the degree to which ultimately what he does will be, geez, I don't know how else to say it, but I'm going to sound really stupid. What he does will be what he did. And that will give us something moving forward to look at as far as a reference point for what to expect from him in the future. And there's 1,000 different things, and Anaheim seems to have, you know, like the three best assets that you can kind of go into this trade deadline with. Mm-hmm. You know, a legitimate top pair shutdown defenseman, a legitimate top four right-handed shot defenseman, and a legitimate right-handed top six winger who can play center. All of them are expiring contracts, and
nice deals too. Like that
can be retained.
Yeah, and like Lindholm's the highest amount.
Phil Kessel or anything.
Yeah, he makes 5.2 or whatever, right? And Rakell again, like we said, Lindholm, right? So
$5.205.
Yeah, so it's not a break the bank, and then yeah, the Ducks can retain it, which what they did on Manson is, you know, four is a lot for a competing team, but if you take him at just over two, it's pretty nice. It's not bad. And in Rakell's case, like almost any team competing can afford him, and whether you can't maybe fit the whole thing under, you don't have to move out a ridiculous contract to fit him in. You can move out a guy who makes like 1.5, and all of a sudden Rakell's only technically costing you 1.5 in that deal, right? So they're good assets to have to move out at this point, and it gives the Ducks you know, some leverage in the market having, you know, three of the most sought after pieces. And it's no surprise that, you know, we're a week away from the deadline, and Manson has been moved out already, and the Ducks got something good for him. And as Firebites mentioned in the chat here, with what some of the defensemen are going for, what the rumored prices are, like, Lindholm should get a haul. Like, that's the real exciting part here, is like, Lindholm, the Ducks could walk away and probably get the biggest trade of trade deadline with Lindholm. Like, maybe more than what Giroux gets for the Flyers if they move him, and maybe not more than JT Miller because he's got term, but when we look at pure rentals, like, the Ducks could get the best package here for one of their players, which is exciting, and it's going to be a first plus a prospect plus, which is exactly where you want to be at this point.
Yeah, no, 100%. So,
you wanted to talk Manson, or not Manson, Matthews suspension, right? Real quick?
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to hit on. I guess the two things that are Toronto-based, or the first of this is, did we talk about this already, but why is Toronto not in on Jacob Chychrun? Like, the fact that it has been, like very clear that they are not in the rumor or in the conversation for Jacob Chychrun. How is that possible?
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, doesn't, like, a young sub $5 million with term top pair left-handed defenseman who has shown growth defensively, has good size, and has a track record of being able to produce offensively at the NHL level. Like is Kyle Dubas officially bad at his job?
I don't know, man. Like, he's starting to get there a little bit. Yeah, like, I mean, he might be in it, and the reports are wrong, but usually, like, the Leafs have not really been in the mix since early on, and for whatever reason that is, the price could be too high. But at this point, like, if you're a team like this, like, there should be nobody else higher on your list than Jacob Chychrun if you're the Leafs. Like, I know, again, like I mentioned in the chat here, the Coyotes are asking for the moon, which they should. But when you're looking at timelines the Leafs have to bring in a guy who only makes 4.7 or whatever Chychrun makes, and you could go Riley Chychrun on the left, and Muzzin plays on his offside on the right anyway. And I'm struggling to remember who their top.
TJ Brody.
Yeah, TJ Brody. So, I mean, you got four lefties in the top, but go pure chaos. But yeah, it's honestly just it's a deal that makes sense, which is why it won't happen for Toronto, and somebody else will eventually pull it off. I know there's a lot of things the Leafs have to do to make any deal work, salary wise. You know, they've got to get Mrazek's deal out of there at some point, because that was just an awful move by them to sign him for 3.5. They've got to move Justin Hall out of there as well. So, like, any deal that they make, they're also asking the Coyotes to take on salary. Which, if the asking price for Chychrun is 2 firsts, your top prospect plus, then you're adding on the fact that the Leafs have to get the Coyotes to take on salary. That, I think, makes it, you know, where the price is just ridiculous, right? It just becomes to an insane level where you just don't feel comfortable doing that. You're talking like this year's first, next year's first, Toby Niemela, another top prospect from your system, plus these guys that you need to move out for salary, then what does that come back? Because it can't really just be Jacob Chychrun. You've got to bring some bodies back, because you're sending so many over to the Coyotes. So
but that's, you can do that, right? You can just tell the Arizona, right? Just pick X number of minor leaguers that you're fine throwing to us. And that's what you do. Like, it's Mrazek and, I don't know, Kerfoot or whatever for Chychrun is fundamentally the deal. Then Mrazek and, like, Hull, right? Like, you can make the salary work. He makes sub $5 million. The thing for me is just pay the fucking price, man. Yeah. Like, it is borderline negligent to not just go get that talent. Like, it just makes no sense. And I don't understand, like, to what point is their name not involved, like actively not involved in this. That's the thing of it, right? Because it's one thing if, like, you, like, X player is available and I haven't heard my team in it. Well, look, that can change at any minute. That's one phone call away. But this is are not interested or are not speaking to. Like, it's just like, how is that possible? And at what point, like, is Kyle Dubas just bad at his job? Like, I get that he inherited some of the contracts and stuff like that, and I don't really have an issue, I guess, with, you know, paying those guys. Like, you have to pay your elite players. Like, I think everybody, given the opportunity, would probably make that John Tavares signing, as much as you can say,
yeah,
you know, the back end of it might really hit you in the kneecap. But the other thing, Eddie, is I think that this is a perfect point to why a luxury tax system and a soft cap would be better, because then they could just give up the picks and the prospects, not have to worry about the salary, and then just also pay real money at the end of the year to Arizona, who need it, because they've got a arena that has 50 fans. So, yeah, and, you know, so that's okay. So that's just that part of it. Like, it's just really, and I guess we'll do more of this kind of crap on next Monday when we're goofing off trying to kill time between trades not happening.
Yes, we need to save as much as we can for that day.
I want to know how you felt about Austin Matthews getting 2 games for his cross-checked Erasmus Dahlin.
Yeah, I'm fine with it. I think it could have been more. Again, this is where I think past history and a superstar comes into it. I think it was pure frustration. I think it's a move you don't want to see like that, where you've got a guy targeting another guy's head. Listen, I get why he's upset. You know, this team is supposed to be good, and they're losing to a team like Buffalo. They're playing outdoors. Everybody's watching it. They haven't had a good run lately. I expected them actually to walk away with nothing. That's just kind of the way I thought it was going to go. I think it was bad enough that they had to give him something. They give him 2 games. I would say it's more closer to the 5 range, if not more. But it's the way it always goes, man. It's Austin Matthews, right? Like, they were never going to give him more than 2. It was just never going to happen. Like, it would have had to have been egregious. And I think Dahlin didn't leave the game, right? He ended up staying in, I think. So
mm-hmm.
there's always something that kind of plays into that. But, again, like, we're in a league that they got to market the superstars the way Matthews is playing right now. This guy was never going to miss more than 2 games.
So I want to ask you now 2 follow-up questions, and they're kind of leading, but I don't mean them to be. Do you think the NHL would have suspended him if that game wasn't an outdoor game on national TV? Like, let me say it this way. I'll just tell you how I feel, because I feel that that suspension is specifically a response to public pressure from the moment that happened in the game until today when they announced it. Like, the amount of public pressure on Twitter from people losing their minds over what Austin Matthews did. Like, I don't think he would have, if that's just a Tuesday game, the exact same thing, but just a Tuesday game, he doesn't get suspended. That's how I feel about that part of it.
I can see it. Like, I definitely think he got more notoriety because of it. I still think it's Toronto, it's Matthews. It's going to get attention no matter what.
That's fair.
The outdoor game adds to it, but the player and the team he plays for, that was always going to draw enough eyes for it to be an issue.
I feel like that's fair, but the only thing I would say to that, I guess, is that, like, we've seen similar-ish incidents from players like McKinnon, Crosby, Connor McDavid.
True, yeah.
You know, where they've gotten off. So I totally understand. And then, do you think Dahlin deserved to get suspended or fined of his own accord? Or do you think what he did was within the play of the game and Matthews overreacted?
I honestly didn't see the first part. What did Dahlin end up doing to lead to that part?
They kind of were, like, fighting in front of the net, and Dahlin gave him one good cross check, and Matthews kind of ended up, like, folded over, and he gave him another good one and sent him teeth first into the crossbar. And that's what Matthews was responding to, was consecutive physical cross checks, one of which sent him face first into the bar. Are you looking for it?
Yeah, I just pulled it up and watched it now. Yeah, listen, like, I think what Dahlin does, at most you could call it roughing, right? Like it I don't think it's as bad. There's no, you know, there's no aiming for the head like you had with Austin Matthews on Dallin. You know, we see these kind of scrums happen all the time. I think.
So you don't buy.
Go ahead.
So you don't buy the stick rolled up his shoulder? You think he went to cross-check him straight in the head? Because that was Matthews' thought. It was what his, allegedly after the game last night, what he said to a reporter is, I was aiming for his shoulder. I didn't mean to hit him in the head. The stick rolled up his shoulder and popped him.
Yeah, listen, I could see it, but what else are you going to come out from that game? You got to plead your case, right? Like he's got to find some way to cover it. I think clearly, like they're losing the game. He's getting bullied in front by this kid in Rasmus Dahlin, and kind of goes down, like you said, knocks his face on the post, doesn't feel great. First instinct is I'm going to beat the shit out of this guy, and you know, turns around, just you know, it's one of those wild stick swinging moments, right, where you see guys who kind of swing the stick. This was obviously a cross check, but I just don't think he was thinking. I don't think he was even intentionally aiming for the head. I think he just turned around and, you know, cross checked whatever was
did what he did,
whatever part of Dallin was in his way, whether it was going to be his shoulder, his side. It turned out to be the side of his head. I think it's just frustration. You black out and you kind of did, that's what happened at that point. And it was unlucky for him that he went for the head, or, you know, as Brett said, aim for the shoulder, but just missed it and got all head. Like it was a mistake at the end. He deserved the suspension. I don't think it makes him a dirty player. Like, listen, I'd be fucking frustrated in the position that he's in right now. This guy's, you know, smoking everybody in the league in terms of goal scoring right now, and his team still loses because they can't keep the puck out of the back of the net, and then they're losing against the Sabres outdoors in Hamilton. So I can, you know, forced to show up in construction gear and hold Tim Hortons cups, and it was just a rough day in general. I don't know if you saw that then. But
I did.
Yeah, it was a rough week all around for Matthews. So he's got a couple of days to cool off and come back and continue to do what he does, which is make teams that play against him, you know, rethink themselves, because he's just that good.
Yeah, so, no kidding.
Yeah, it's a tough one. But at the end of the day, I think what Dallin does is within the rules. It's borderline roughing, but you know, it's one of those games you kind of let the guys play. And Matthews, his response, whether he meant it or not, is with, you know, it's outside the rules, and he got what he kind of deserved for that one. So
yeah, I get that. I mean, I you know, I would say for me personally, I feel like the part of it that goes, that takes it outside of a normal scrum, is the fact that there was nobody around and he sent him face first into the crossbar. Like, that's the part of it to me that I think is distinguishable from anything else. I also, you know, I get you cross-check a guy in the head, you get two games. Like, I think that's reasonable. I get that some people think it should have been more, but to your credit, or to your point, he was a star. That was never going to happen. That doesn't bother me. I definitely think it's fine that star players get treated differently than other players, whether it's calls or no calls in game, or it's shit like that after the whistle. Like, it doesn't bother me. Like,
for him too,
they're
right?
The ones they're the ones who make the money. You know what I mean? Like, you got to do what you got to do. Like you said, he's destroying the league in terms of goal scoring. He's the most exciting player in the world right now. And he was never going to not miss.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he was never going to miss significant time. But yeah, I just want to get your thoughts on it, because I saw a lot of different people talking about it today, and I just felt like, I don't know, I feel like it's kind of we're getting more and more into big hubbaloos about nothing. But I also know that I'm just like a cranky old person. So,
all right, I want to wrap it up here. We had a question from a new viewer in the chat. It was answered by one of our chatters, but I just wanted to answer it on the show. So asking if newly acquired Drew Helison is signed, he's going into his third year of college, doesn't have an entry-level contract. No, he's not signed right now. The Ducks have the ability to sign him at any point that they want to. He has the option to tell the Ducks, though, that he wants to go back for his senior year, his final year of college. So the option right now is up to Drew Helison. I would imagine he signs and plays with San Diego for a bit and gets a handful of games with the Ducks. That's the way I approach it. I can't imagine he goes back. He has nothing left to prove in college, but sometimes guys just like to figure it out. Now, it's a bad situation potentially for the Ducks if he does go back for his senior year, because we run into that like Justin Schultz type situation where he can become an unrestricted free agent because he isn't signed to a contract. So
you said the evil name.
Yeah, I don't want to get into that because that's negative thinking, but I would imagine, and I would put money on him signing in the near future here. Maybe the Ducks wait until after the deadline just to kind of focus on what they need to be focusing right now, but probably by, you know, early April, I would expect him to be signed and playing some games and getting a handful of games with the Ducks by the end of the year.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Damn, I am so sorry, Brett. We are out of time tonight, but we will get to your question about why Johnny Hockey is better than Connor McDavid and America is better than Canada on Monday's super special trade show.
We need
in
some
which
stuff.
I'm going to make Eddie.
Monday.
I'm going to get Eddie to just get himself killed as many times as possible playing Elden Ring.
Yeah.
And I'm just going
to
sit and laugh.
Hopefully we can figure that out, because we'll need something to do on Monday. But yeah, for anybody wondering what we're talking about, Monday's trade deadline. We will be live in some capacity trying to do a show and just kind of shooting the shit while we have
just
the trades running. Yeah. Both have the day off, so we got to find something to do on that day. And I would hope that Lindholm and Raquel can hold it out a little bit, and Verbeek can wait until Monday so give us some contact, at least Sunday night, so we can spend the first couple hours talking about the Lindholm trade and the Raquel trade and some of the big deals as they come in. But as the deadline has worked over the last couple of years, there is usually not much going on for Monday. So we'll see. We're going to be on here no matter what.
I don't know. We got Kevin Weeks, insider now. So,
yeah.
You know,
he's
we might
modernizing
start getting TikTok
the game,
announcements.
Dude. Video announcements
of
for
trade. I know. It was awesome, dude. It's our hockey fans.
Dude, it doesn't keep care about being the first. Like, that's what I liked. Isn't worried that somebody else could beat him to it, like took the time to record the video and post it. Wait for the video to upload onto Twitter for him to post it. Just great. Love it.
Yeah, that's the title of this episode, Why Kevin Weeks is the Best NHL Insider.
Hey, tune in on Monday and find out. So.
Yeah, I know shit.
All right,
everybody.
Thanks for coming out, guys. At least we had some stuff to talk about with the Josh Manson trade. We got some stuff planned beyond the Monday show as well, and hoping that Pat and Jay can join us back here at some point and bless you with their presence on the show. Appreciate you guys coming out. Now I'm rambling. We have Patreon stuff to announce, but I realize we already announced it in the group chat. But we'll go over that on Monday too, with the Patreon stuff and what the plan is with that for right now. But anyway, guys, appreciate you guys coming out. Appreciate everybody listening after the fact, and we'll see you on Monday. Take care, guys.
Bye, everybody.